This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Democrats will have six candidates to choose from in Southwest Michigan's 6th Congressional District when they vote in August. One of them will challenge Republican Congressman Fred Upton in November. Rich Eichholz stresses his background as a scientist and business leader in his campaign for Congress. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Gordon.
Tell us a little bit more about being a scientist and business leader and maybe some more of your background, why you'd like to represent the 6th Congressional District in Congress.
Yep, sure. So my science background is I'm a biologist, graduate school in biology, and then I got started in business. About halfway through graduate school, I realized I wasn't cut out for academia. So I got started in business and working in research and development, and migrated over to marketing and then strategic planning, and then eventually moved on to another company, Abbott Laboratories, and then on to I became a partner in a consulting firm that worked with smaller startup companies, mostly pharmaceutical diagnostic companies, helping them develop the products in the clinic and then get them out into the marketplace.
So why would you like to be the next representative for the 6th Congressional District?
Yeah, if you know, I can take it kind of into three different time frames, if you would. One is the most obvious one, which I think probably the proximate cause for most people who are running is after the election last year, kind of woke up and said, you know, am I really doing everything that I can? But if I just take a step back, I think that you can look at the seeds of my running were really planted about 20 years ago. When I took up two hobbies, my wife calls them obsessions, yeah, she's probably right, actually. But one was to finally be able to move over here to Southwest Michigan, and we started rebuilding our house here at that point. And then the other was I started studying the relationship between economic vitality and income disparity. And I became convinced that the growing income disparity in our country over at that point through the previous three decades was actually one of the underlying causes of our declining economic growth. And at that point, I actually, you know, of course, was talking to all my friends and relatives about it and so forth. And my sister, who was living in Vermont at the time, said, well, you should start following this our local congressman here. He's been talking about that as well. And of course, that was Bernie Sanders. And so that's been kind of gnawing at me for about 20 years, and I've kept tracking it. It's in our district here, and the time that Fred Upton's been our congressman, economic growth has gone from 2% down to 0%, and I think everybody knows what's happening to income disparity in this district as well.
So what do you do about income disparity? You know, does that mean higher taxes on wealthier people? Does it mean some sort of you know, subsidy for people at the bottom of the scale? Does it mean some of both?
So it means some of all of that and probably more. If you look back to the 50s and 60s, we had a really good balance at that time between the amount of revenue that was coming out in the form of profit and the amount of revenue that was coming out in the form of wages. We have a consumer-based economy, right? Everybody agrees. Some people forget that if you have a consumer-based economy, consumers need money to spend. And so we've been pushing, you know, the profit side up for like the last 50 years, and we've been pushing the wages part down over the last 50 years. So we have to do a whole bunch of things to right that ship. Some of it is just letting the taxes get back to where we had them as recently as the Obama administration. Some of it is restoring or removing the cap on Social Security income that's subject to Social Security tax so that we can raise that. Then there's also the whole kind of the diminishing of the influence of unions. So, you know, not only do we need to raise the minimum wage so that everyone who works 40 hours a week has a living wage, but we also need to make sure that we're pushing up the income for other workers, skilled workers, and tradesmen who, you know, used to have the unions to support them. But there's been, as you know, a decline in the influence of unions due to some of the a lot of the state laws. So
specifically on Social Security, would you be in favor of raising the cap on income that can be taxed for Social Security, or would you be in favor of just eliminating it altogether?
Eliminating it. Yeah, I would rather just eliminate it. And, you know, one of the other solutions, you know, that this proposes means testing. But I'm not really in favor of cutting down on the benefits side in any way. I'm not intrinsically opposed to the means testing, but I just doubt that we could actually save enough money that way to pay for the amount of administration work that would have to be accomplished for that. And so I think the much simpler and more economically sound way would just be to eliminate the cap.
On healthcare, you have said that you support the shortest path to universal healthcare. You say you're not terribly concerned about how that actually happens, but aren't the details important in terms of how you're going to administer it, where you might have to increase taxes, where you might have to make changes in regulation?
Absolutely. I mean, the details are really important, but it's also even more important that we don't lose focus and make sure that we're working towards universal health care. Because here's what I found after working for 30 years in just about every aspect of the healthcare business, in particular on interviewing insurers both here in the United States and over in Europe and tracking all of this. Basically, as many people know, as many people don't know, the rest of the developed world has better healthcare outcomes than we do at half the cost. And really, the difference simply is that they have universal healthcare. But if you look at their systems, it's a myriad of different systems. There are very few single-payer, what we might call Medicare for All, systems in the world. The UK, Canada, Taiwan, that's about it. And even those aren't really quite, the ideal single-payer. They also have some commercial elements to them. But all the other countries are different combinations of government insurance and private insurance. So for me personally, my first step would be to make sure that we have the public option on the healthcare exchanges. I believe that would not only give a whole nother group of people access to healthcare and real access to healthcare, but it would also directly through the government. But I think it would also serve as a marker in the marketplace for insurers to have to compete against, so that we could have fewer regulations and more open competition.
A public option meaning that somebody who goes through the exchange, they could say opt into, would you say Medicare?
Medicare or Medicaid or, you know, some government program that meets the minimum standards of that have been set up in the Affordable Care Act, because I think those are really good, viable minimum standards, you know, annual preventive care as well as treatment.
You've said that you want to promote clean jobs or green jobs, as some people say. Mm-hmm. Do we have to pick winners and losers here in order to do that? Do we have to say that maybe some old-style manufacturing jobs, which we've been trying to hold on to, we're just not going to be able to do that in order to promote more of a green economy?
No, I don't see the green economy as being in competition with other manufacturing. Certainly, I actually believe that they're they'll complement each other, but I do think that we may need to make sure that as we develop new manufacturing jobs, that they're done in a green way. But that's, for me, that's just another sustainable, another element of the sustainable economy. The competition is that we need to start leaving fossil fuels in the ground, and so that's the competition that I see, that we need to develop clean energy jobs, clean renewable energy jobs to replace fossil fuel-based jobs, because we need to leave the fossil fuels on the ground.
Do you think that there is a particular form of renewable energy, solar, wind, or what have you, which is the one that makes the most sense, or seems to be the most viable out of the ones out there?
Michigan's pretty, a lot of people look at the weather like today, it's a little bit cloudy, and say, well, Michigan doesn't have enough solar capacity or enough wind capacity. Actually, we're better than average. We're probably in the upper third of all the states for both. So I think Michigan is one state where both of those can do quite well. And so I think it's kind of we can see that there are some local resistance to green energy. We have a proposed plant in the Menden area that has gotten a little bit of flack from the community, to say the least. But I think some of that is just resistance to change, but I don't think either one would necessarily supplant the other one. The only other thing I would say, though, is that the thing that Michigan has plenty of is water. Even if we were already giving too much of it away to Nestle, we still have a lot of water, and that's actually the best battery right now for renewable energy, intermittent, like wind and solar. Basically, just pump water uphill and let it fall back down. Is really right now the most viable battery storage. So that's an intrinsically intrinsic advantage that Michigan has.
So if we're trying to get people trained for these jobs, which may be in green energy, clean energy jobs, what's the education policy of the United States got to be to try to bring that about, as well as increase the number of college graduates, et cetera?
Yeah. So the one thing I'm going to probably end up talking too much about the technical training and so forth, because what we don't know about the future is what the balance is going to be between those kinds of jobs, which are where, you might say that there's STEM education is education for STEM jobs, and training would be paramount, right? Or how much of it is really going to be human-human interactions, and so we need people who are trained in the arts and music and so forth. And so I would just start from pre-K, which, we still are not doing enough for pre-K, we have way too many kids that are coming out of coming into even elementary school, and they're not ready. And so we need to really be focused on that. And I would make sure that we don't leave any students behind. We get all of our schools up to where they should be. And that means for some schools, they need extra help. But then, of course, as we get older, as we look at the older students, we need to support community colleges, because a lot of the jobs do require some training, some expertise. Many of them don't require 4-year education and so forth. But we need to make sure that we're providing access for that, and also obviously for college. And the other area where I'm in really staunch agreement with Bernie Sanders is I believe that the transaction tax on Wall Street trades is a perfectly legitimate and non-harmful to the economy tax. The level of taxation that we're talking about there is not going to prevent anybody from making an investment in any firm, but it will start accumulating money that can be spent on college tuition and relief for college debt from people who are just engaging in essentially gambling through trading.
So let's go to that transaction tax for just a moment. Mm-hmm. There is your plan, or would your goal be with that community college would be free, as some people have suggested, or maybe beyond that, or maybe that it might be funneled more towards students who would have a harder time affording college than perhaps the very wealthy?
If it turned out to be large enough that it would provide free tuition for everyone in community college and free 4-year tuition for everyone at a state college, and relieve the students, the ex-students who are already burdened with the debt, I would, of course, love to do that. I don't know if it's going to be that large. I frankly would start with the students who are already suffering under the ex-students who are already suffering under debt. I think that they have been put into a system that was not the system when I went to college. There are we're trying to make money off of people going to college. The government doesn't need to be doing that. We need to be helping people go to college. And so the first thing I would do would be provide relief for people who are already struggling under the student debt. And then the second priority, I think, would be for community colleges.
On immigration, you kind of make a point in this point category on your website about trying to address human rights and suffering, and that the goal should not entirely be trying to bring in skilled workers. But, is that also part of it, that we are looking for people who can fill jobs here? And how much can we do on the other side to address trying to alleviate suffering for people who may be in a very troubled part of the world.
Yeah. So I think the first thing we need to do to when we say that we need to bring in, you know, people with expert training and education is to look ourselves in the mirror and say, why is that? Didn't we have the greatest education system in the world? So I think that should be the first question we should ask. And it may be for short term that we need to, but that should also be a wake up call that we need to do more about our education system. And then I do think that our traditions were that we bring in the tired, the poor, the hungry, and I'm sorry, I'm not getting the quote exactly right, but I think you get the point that we weren't being selective, right? And that's really the beauty of it. If you just look at what a success that approach has been, I don't see why we wouldn't just continue with that, because every wave of immigration that we've had has contributed both culturally and economically to the success of this country.
Do there have to be some limits, though, on just the sheer numbers? Because we could find a lot of places in the world where we can make a good humanitarian case for bringing people in that could result in a lot of people. So is there some sort of cap that there should be in place there?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we can just open up the floodgates or whatever. And so, you know, there does have to be a cap. But right now, what we need to recognize is we actually need more workers because we'll have a whole bunch of people in Social Security age retiring. As we talked about, you know, lifting the cap on the income that's subject to Social Security, that's certainly part of the solution. But that actually won't fix the whole problem. And so we actually do need some more workers in here. And so if we're thinking about what the limits are, well, until we get to the point where we have enough workers to support the Social Security system, I guess we haven't got to that limit yet.
So if the nation's gun policy were strictly going to be written by Rich Eichholz, what would it say?
I don't think I would write a gun policy just, you know, for myself, but I will tell you because I think it's a collective community kind of sense, and we have people in different parts of the community that feel different things, and so I would really much more think that we need to have a policy that everyone agrees that we can live with, literally.
Everyone, 325 million people in the country—that's pretty tough, isn't it?
Pretty much. But at least everyone in the different kind of cultural norms, if you will.
People who are in favor
people
of gun rights.
People in rural areas and who are strongly in favor of, you know, no restrictions, and people in urban areas who may want a lot of restrictions. And we're all going to have to find a way to compromise our way through here. But I think the starting point that I make everywhere, and so it's on the radio now, so that's pretty far, is that basically I am convinced that there is a constitutional right for individuals to own guns for hunting and for defense of the home. Beyond that, then I think it's up to us as a society to see, you know, how much we want guns involved in society, where they should be, under what conditions and what times and so forth. I don't believe personally that we really need assault weapons out on the street available. I think they're fine as a form of entertainment and fun, and but they could probably be managed on firing ranges, for instance. But that's me personally, and if as a society we think that we need to have some of them out there, but I would just argue that we don't really want. I don't think there are many people that really want our police outgunned. So I think that's kind of a standard that I would hold up as well. And on April 7th, heeding the call of the Parkland students, we held a town hall on gun violence in Benton Harbor. And I won't hold that up as, you know, the final solution because it was just an open discussion between gun rights advocates and people who are strongly favoring gun restrictions, and then people in the middle who are just kind of like, well, I'm not sure what. But, you know, this isn't good, what's going on. And one of the things that came out of that was just kind of thinking about guns as we do about automobiles, you know, dangerous pieces of equipment that have a function, right? We require people to register their automobiles on an annual basis. And there was a general sense in that group, and I won't say that that's, you know, transmitted everywhere else, but a general sense in that group, which was a fairly wide representation of people, that an annual registration requirement for guns, just so, you know, the state, and that's just a point for me that I've got a Jeffersonian in my heart. I really don't want the federal government involved in gun regulation. I think it should be a state issue, but so that the state would once a year know where the gun is and that it's being taken care of. The other points I think that most everyone agrees on is that we need a federal background system. If it could be state, I would have it be state, but it wouldn't really work. So I think it has to be we have to continue with our national background check system, but make sure that it's working for everyone.
If you were a member of Congress, and if you do become a member of Congress at some point in the future, when would you say that U.S. interest reaches a point that it would merit military action?
When there's an imminent threat to our homeland, we have gotten ourselves into a whole bunch of wars that we didn't need to. And I think we need to restore Congress's responsibility in this regard. I don't think not many people anyway, would argue that Congress made a mistake by declaring war in World War II. So it's all the wars after that that weren't actually with congressional approval that have really caused a lot of the problems that we've faced. And so I think it has to be an imminent threat and it has to be declared by Congress.
There's a fair amount of money being raised in this race, but the three candidates who have raised more than you, they have a fairly sizable lead.
Yep.
Can you make the case, as you're out there, that if you are the nominee, you can bring in enough money that you're going to be able to run a competitive campaign against a well-funded incumbent who's been there for over 30 years?
Yeah. First of all, I congratulate the other three who are ahead of me. It's hard raising money, and they're both, also two of them in particular, are quite good at it. And so I have a lot of respect for their ability. But I will tell you that I have a very wide net of donors, and I also have a lot of people who have committed to me once the primary is over. So I'm ready to go on August 8th, calling in all those chips. And yes, I do think that I will definitely be able to raise enough
once the primary is over. People are committed.
Yep. And yep. Mm-hmm.
So you are from the western, southwestern edge of this district.
You can hardly get more southwest in southwest Michigan than Union Pier, yeah.
The other candidates who are running are from the Kalamazoo area. And if you look at this district, Kalamazoo County was one of eight counties in the state that went for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So can you get the energy that the Democrat might need or probably will need in November up to a level that you can defeat Fred Upton?
Are you specifically thinking about the Democrats in the district?
Yeah, right. Because you're going to need a big turnout, right?
Yep. Our campaign is working in all six counties, working really hard. We recognize that half of the Democrats are in Kalamazoo County, and so we're spending about half of our time here building our base, and we're doing quite well there as well. So, I'm absolutely confident that we'd be able to.
What would having a scientist in the House, or just even as the Democratic nominee in the fall, mean for the 6th District of Michigan?
Yep. So I think it'd be a change. We have right now congressman who, it's hard to say, is he a climate change denier or not? I mean, he just joined the Climate Protection Caucus. And so, but it's pretty clear he was chairman of Energy and Commerce for 6 years. And if you look at the record, all that he did was to double down on fossil fuels. And what you'll have is somebody that's asking hard questions, listening to fact-based arguments, and moving forward based on facts and not just fiction.
So before we actually started recording, I heard you use the term blue wave, mm-hmm. Or perhaps it was your son who's joined us here, use the term blue wave. Waves always crest someplace. So, how do you make the argument to Democrats out there that you can take advantage, if there is, in fact, a blue wave, that you can be the person that takes advantage of that and turns a seat which has been red for many, many decades blue.
Yep. So I think the way for a Democrat to win this district is very straightforward. Before I ever threw my hat in the ring, I did what I've been doing for 20 years, which is basically building forecast models to see how competitors are going to compete and what their strengths and weaknesses are. And really, if you just look at the math, what has to happen in this district for a Democrat to win, it's they have to be able to turn out all the Democrats. And they also have to be able to convince some of the moderate Republicans and independents in this district who have been voting for Fred Upton to switch their vote for a Democrat for the first time ever. Everywhere I go, I find that my positions and my background resonate very strongly with Democrats. There's no doubt that some of my opponents in the primary can appeal a little bit more strongly than I do and to the Democrats, but I'm quite confident that I can appeal strong enough that they will definitely come out and vote for me and support me.
You are not the only candidate who has used Bernie Sanders' name at some point in an interview. Do you think voters look at Bernie Sanders and see that, you know, especially if they are an independent or a Republican, and say, oh, that's the kind of Democrat I can get behind, as someone who seems to share some of Bernie Sanders' ideas, if not consider themselves a full-blown Bernie Sanders Democrat?
Well, obviously, the full-blown Bernie Democrats are attracted to that, so that's not the problem. But the other part is that in terms of the moderate Republicans and independents, you know, Bernie does not necessarily appeal to them, and a lot of that is just rhetoric, right? And I'm pro-business, right? I'm pro-business, and I don't mind saying it right now. I'm especially pro-small business. But I do recognize that this whole income disparity and economic vitality situation is real, and that it is part of what's been going on. And I think intrinsically people understand that. Intrinsically people do really get that consumers need money to spend. And so I think when I appeal that way to the moderate Republicans and I don't vilify businesses, then I think that it does. I think it does appeal to them. In fact, I know it does. Yeah.
Rich Eichholz is one of six Democrats running for his party's nomination in Southwest Michigan's 6th Congressional District. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
The winner of the August Democratic primary will challenge Republican Congressman Fred Upton in November. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.